The Dutch Model, today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. Over the centuries, the Dutch have learned to live with the risk of flooding. Don't fight the water. Live with it. This expert says there's a lesson here for California wildfires.
You essentially have this idea where the fire is moving towards a community, and the community is actually built in such a way that the fire sort of goes around it.
Also, President Trump refuses to blame Saudi Arabia's crown prince for the murder of Jamal Khashoggi. A longtime U.S. diplomat says that sends a clear message.
It's going to be business as usual. The Saudis are far too important. The relationship is too big to fail. And it's driven by a series of assumptions that simply don't add up.
Those stories today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thanks for joining us today. It's not so much a mystery, but pretty much everyone agrees that it was a murder, plain and simple. In the big picture, though, there's very little that is simple about the killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi. The CIA and members of Congress from both parties appear to agree that this was a murder ordered by the Saudi leadership. The real question now, what is the Trump administration going to do about it? President Trump issued a written statement today about, quote, standing with Saudi Arabia. That statement was issued during the conversation you're about to hear with former State Department advisor on Middle East affairs, Aaron David Miller. He's with the Wilson Center in Washington. I started by asking him to lay out what we know about the murder so far, according to U.S. intelligence.
On two occasions, intimates very close to the crown prince made phone calls, first from the king's younger brother, Khalid bin Salman, who was the ambassador to Washington, since departed, urging Jamal Khashoggi to go to the consulate in Istanbul without fear for his safety. The second is from one of the members of what is clearly the Saudi hit team, who is frequently seen with the crown prince, part of his security detail or apparatus, calling home to basically say mission accomplished. But I suspect that unless the agency has another piece of audio which has the crown prince on record, directly implicates him, I suspect that the administration will avoid sanctions or punitive action that directly targets either the king or MBS.
I mean, there have been mixed messages, as you know, from the U.S. government on this. I'm just wondering, based on your experience with several other presidents, what kind of response would you expect?
Well, we've been placating and assuaging the Saudis for years. And the reality is, it is an important relationship. I wouldn't call Saudi Arabia an ally of the United States. It's a security partner. An ally status is reserved for countries that share common values and common interests. But episodically, we share interests. And what amazes me is, having worked for a half a dozen secretaries of state of both political parties, the degree to which this administration has A, invested in the Saudis, and B, the degree to which they're prepared to give Mohammed bin Salman and policies that he has pursued, which have been exceedingly reckless and impulsive, a green light without constraint, without any accountability.
Do you think other White Houses, other presidents would have said, this is a red line?
I think that all would have sought to navigate the line between a relationship that needs to be sustained for security reasons and economic reasons, and one that needs to be reset. So no, I don't think any administration would have adopted measures that would fundamentally have undermined the relationship. But that doesn't mean we can't impose costs in an effort to deter and constrain a man who could be king of Saudi Arabia for the next half century, 50 years.
Well, speaking of values, I mean, National Security Council advisor Kirsten Fontenrose had pushed for tough measures against the Saudi government and was recently in Riyadh to discuss sanctions, at least according to the New York Times. But she resigned on Friday, and we don't know the exact circumstances. But does it worry you that someone in the White House who was offering what seemed to be a dissenting opinion on Saudi is now out?
Yeah, it worries me greatly. It bothers me, number one, that the president couldn't listen to what he himself described as a suffering tape, which suggests a certain degree of distance. It bothers me that there doesn't appear to be a lot of curiosity in the administration. I remember as a young INR analyst at State Department getting a phone call one morning. I was following Lebanon and the Palestinians, and it was Vice President George H.W. Bush on the phone, and who said, "I'd read one of your memos on Lebanon. I know you're busy," he said, "but do you have a few minutes to talk about it?" And I hung up the phone, and I thought to myself, you know, this guy knows what he doesn't know, and he's in a hurry to find out. We don't really have that kind of curiosity. And finally, Marco, I think there is far too much of a personalization of our foreign policy. As the president seems to believe that by investing personally in these relationships, that he can substitute American foreign policy. And I think a lot of this, frankly, is magical thinking.
Aaron David Miller, I just want to read you part of a statement that just came out from President Trump regarding Saudi Arabia. He's talking about the country of Iran, as an example, is responsible for a bloody proxy war against Saudi Arabia and Yemen, trying to destabilize Iraq's fragile attempt at democracy, propping up dictator Bashar Assad in Syria. After my heavily negotiated trip to Saudi Arabia last year, the kingdom agreed to spend and invest $450 billion in the United States, a record amount of money. So the president seems to be drawing a line between support of Saudi Arabia and stability in the region. What do you make of this?
What I make is that that statement is designed to put the final lid on the Jamal Khashoggi affair. This basically says to me that it's going to be business as usual, that the Saudis are far too important, relationship is too big to fail, and it's driven by a series of assumptions that simply don't add up. The Saudis have not bought $110 billion in arms, as the president maintains. The Saudis have not created 500,000 or 1 million jobs in the United States, as the president maintains. The Saudis have not been a force for stability in the region. In fact, you could make a compelling case that the Saudis have been a catalyst for instability. So I do understand what the president is doing, but I think it's bad for American values. It's bad for American interests. And it may be smart politics, but it's really dumb policy.
Let me read you one other line from this statement. Our intelligence agencies continue to assess all information, but it could very well be that the Crown Prince had knowledge of this tragic event. Maybe he did, and maybe he didn't. Haven't we heard that before?
Yeah, and I think that leaves you with the president and the administration able to maintain the relationship. But if this doesn't alter American behavior, if there's no accountability, no change in policy, and we don't use this as leverage, which is the other core issue here, it's basically business as usual. And I suspect that we're going to allow this moment to slip away, and we're going to return to the notion that the relationship is too big to fail, and that jobs and arms sales, as meager as they are, provides the president with a kind of America First rationale to justify keeping on as he's been doing over the last year and a half.
Aaron David Miller, former State Department analyst and negotiator under six presidents. Good to have you on the show. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Marco.
Maybe you're excited by it, you might be dreading it, or disgusted by it. Either way, Black Friday is this week. That means the holiday shopping season is kicking off. Some good news on that, there don't appear to be major price hikes just yet. But if President Trump's trade war with China continues, that might change. The tariffs are set to increase in January. As the world's Jason Margolis reports, that's got some small businesses on edge.
Sea Eagle Boats began selling inflatable kayaks back in 1968. Today, the 30-person company also sells inflatable boats, canoes, and rafts. These are not cheap, throwaway, blow-up boats. At his headquarters in Port Jefferson on Long Island, New York, company president Cecil Hogue shows me a deflated fishing vessel.
It takes about 5 minutes to fully inflate this boat with this pump. And over time, I've gotten a lot of leg exercise.
That's one way of doing it.
Hogue's business partner and brother, John Hogue, fires up an electric pump to speed things along. Pretty quickly, the boat is rock solid, and it feels like hard plastic.
It's a much more rigid boat. You can see it has a real structure to it that other inflatables couldn't attain until this technology was developed.
And they deflate easily for storage. Sea Eagle's patented boats were designed on Long Island, but have long been built in China. Before that, they came from Europe. Starting in September, the Hogue brothers began paying a 10% import tax on their products from China. That tariff is scheduled to shoot up to 25% come January. The Hogue brothers will try to pass that cost along to their customers, but John Hogue is worried.
The average American consumer hasn't had much of a raise in the last few years. and middle-class families can spend some money on recreation, but
if a $2,000 fishing skiff starts selling for $2,500, that might give shoppers pause. But a major point to President Trump's tariffs has been to drive manufacturing back to the United States. Cecil Hoag says with their products, easier said than done.
The problem is that to recreate the factories that we're importing from would be about $500 million. Last year, we sold $10 million of goods. We don't have the $500 million. I'm sorry.
So they basically need to stick with China, at least in the short term. John Hoag understands another one of the president's goals, to stop Chinese companies from forcing Americans to give up intellectual property in order to build in China. Most agree that's a real problem.
Yeah, I think President Trump and the administration should address the issues with China on a case-by-case basis.
But he doesn't think his company should be punished. Economists disagree on a lot, but not on tariffs. The overwhelming majority say slapping tariffs on thousands of items is a crude economic tool, not an effective way to address ongoing trade problems with the Chinese. And while this might sound like a tough luck case for a 30-person company on Long Island, think again. The American boating industry employs a lot of people.
650,000. So everything from who makes the boat to selling the boat, repairing it, the marinas and service shops that are out there, it's quite a big industry.
That's Nicole Vassilaris with the National Marine Manufacturers Association. She says more than 350 marine-related products are being hit by tariffs on Chinese imports.
It's everything from ropes to the wheels on trailer tires to marine engines and fiberglass.
The list also includes things like navigation equipment and antennas. Vassilaris says you can't just shift production on a dime. And ultimately, factories probably wouldn't move from China to, say, Ohio or Alabama.
And what's the end goal? If we take things from China and we move them to Vietnam or move it somewhere in the South Pacific, is that really helping or is that just causing an extra burden on U.S. manufacturers?
A lot of boating equipment is still manufactured in the United States. Taco Metals in Miami builds things like deck hardware, stainless steel railings and hinges. Bill Kushner with Taco Metals says their products are designed and produced in the U.S., but their raw material imports, steel and aluminum, are being taxed. And he's worried how long this will continue.
In essence, you know, it's isolationism and protectionism that is going to keep us from really being a part of the global economy.
He says for small manufacturers, the tariffs are going to cost more jobs than they create. That's one opinion.
I think it's too early to tell what the impact of the tariffs will be.
Scott Paul is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. His organization estimates that the U.S. has lost 2.7 million manufacturing jobs since China joined the World Trade Organization in 2001. Many of those job losses were due to improvements in technology. Still, Paul says if the tariffs can bring about some changes in our relationship with China, it may be worth it.
And the tariffs provide us with some leverage that we have lacked. But I will candidly admit, these tariffs are as much of an experiment as letting China into the world trade system was in the first place.
But this experiment is causing anxiety for small family-run businesses like Sea Eagle Boats.
You know, we've gone through oil shocks and recessions, but nothing that was deliberately created by our own government. No, nothing like this.
John Hoag says if the tariffs increase in January and their boats are priced too high and sales fall, that means less money to pay their Long Island staff, people working in sales, marketing, web design, and accounting.
All those jobs are at risk.
And economists warn that scenario could also play out across tens of thousands of American businesses. For The World, Jason Margolis, Port Jefferson, New York.
Just ahead, taking a cue from the Dutch when it comes to wildfires. You're with The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. What can we learn about fire from water? A few years ago, I was in New Orleans reporting on a group of urban planners who were getting advice from the Dutch about how to deal with too much water. Hurricane Katrina and other storms since 2005 have been big problems for the city. The advice from a country below sea level was simple. Don't fight the water. Learn to live with it. a strategy that seems to have worked pretty well for the Netherlands over many centuries. Now, what if you could apply that to dealing with fire? Crystal Coleman thinks it's possible. She used to work battling wildfires. Now Coleman teaches fire management at the University of Idaho.
The Dutch, of course, spent centuries trying to keep the floods out. And what they have learned from a series of large catastrophic floods is that they need to try and instead let the water in and build their infrastructure to facilitate allowing the floods to happen while keeping people safe and critical infrastructure safe. And then as the floods subside, then operations resume back to normal.
So how do you take that Dutch model and apply it to fire?
Well, if we focus on saving lives and protecting critical infrastructure by rebuilding things to have non-flammable houses, to have space where there's not very much fuel for those fires around homes and critical infrastructure, then fires can burn past towns instead of burning them down. And, you know, when I say something like allowing fires to burn past a town, many people imagine sort of sitting in their house looking out the window and seeing a fire go roaring by. And that's not really what actually happens. Instead, what we have seen in some communities is this development of what the Australians pioneered, which is a shelter-in-place model. And having people be in buildings that are really, really resistant to combusting, and having whole communities that are actually resistant to fire, such that if a fire is coming down out of a forest or across much of California and even other parts of the country, we have grasslands and shrublands. And so you essentially have this idea where the fire is moving towards a community, and like Moses parting the Red Sea, the community is actually built in such a way that the fire sort of goes around it.
Okay, hang on a sec, because something occurred to us after the interview. It was hard to believe that many houses in California are not already fire resistant. So we emailed Coleman. She said that California has some of the strictest wildfire building codes in the country. Still, many homeowners use a lot of wood siding and decking. They also plant trees in their yards, and that adds more fuel. Also, houses built before the strict building codes were passed in the 1990s, they're still flammable. All right, now back to the interview. I asked Coleman about changing to a Dutch model of living with fire. Is that even possible here?
The U.S., of course, is a very diverse place. And if we look at the southeastern U.S., that is already a place that's living with fire. And I've done a fair amount of work talking to fire managers in the Southeast, and what they tell me is that people in the Southeast expect that there's going to be a little bit of controlled burning every single year to reduce a lot of the fuels in and around their homes. And they understand that that fire is controlled, and they understand that there's going to be a little bit of smoke, and they live with that so that they don't have to have that threat of wildfire hanging over their heads. In the Western U.S., we don't have that mentality. And there's a whole host of reasons for that. But a big piece of it is many people who move to the West do so because they value these scenic vistas looking out over forests and beautiful valleys. And they don't want to have that pall of smoke hanging overhead. They don't want to be looking at burned forests where all that's left is standing black twigs, basically. And so there's this idea that they shouldn't have to live with fire in the West. And unfortunately, what we're seeing, particularly with climate change, is that that's not true at all. We do have to learn to live with fire in the West because all of that vegetation that comprises their scenic vista is fuel for those fires.
And I'm wondering if there's another paradigm shift as well, because shifting from running from fires or dying from fires, I mean, the Dutch model would have us live with fire. Do you think there's something very American in behaving like we can control nature?
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, part of that is also our own fault, and particularly the Forest Service. used a war on fire approach and advertising scheme throughout the 40s, initiating with the Second World War. And they actually likened fighting fires to the war on the Axis.
You're saying Smokey the Bear had a previous life fighting Hitler and Mussolini?
He did. You can look at some of these old ads from the earlier part of the 20th century. And, you know, this was a major fear during World War II. And in fact, the Japanese actually launched balloons with candles in them where they were trying to initiate forest fires in the Western U.S.
Wow.
During World War II. Failed miserably. But there was a recognition that if we had major forest fires during World War II, when most of our young men were already overseas fighting, that it would further cripple the country at a critical time. And so there was this real parallel drawn by the Forest Service and their agencies between wildfire and our enemies overseas.
You now teach fire science, Crystal, but you used to be a wildland firefighter on the ground. How does what's going on in California right now compare to what you've seen? What's occurring to you?
You know, the biggest change over the years is that we have much more intense fires that move more quickly. And that is very much a function of these fuels, the vegetation and a lot of the wood material that's on the ground being more flammable due to drier conditions, some of the drought conditions that are present now in the West, and very much a function of climate change, warmer, drier conditions, more frequent droughts, longer, more intense droughts. All of these things contribute to having more dead and available vegetation that is drier. And just like when you try and burn a piece of green firewood in the fireplace and it smokes and it smolders and it doesn't, it just doesn't burn very well. So then instead, you get the green log off of there and you get the nice cured piece of firewood and that burns great. And that's what we're seeing on the ground in California and across parts of the West, that what used to be greenwood that would just sort of smoke and smolder and not burn as intensely, that's now incredibly well cured. And that contributes to just amazing fire behavior.
Yeah. Crystal Colden teaches fire science at the University of Idaho. Thank you for being with us today, Crystal.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Marco Werman. A court blocks President Trump's order restricting where migrants can ask for asylum. And the ACLU argues the president can't go around Congress on this one.
Congress has said, look, asylum is special, asylum is fundamental. Where you enter the country has no bearing on your right to apply for asylum.
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Seeking safe refuge here in the U.S. from violence or oppression in other countries has long been legal. It's also central to this country's identity. It says so on the Statue of Liberty. But President Trump has argued that migrants are taking advantage of U.S. asylum protections and that they're overwhelming the system.
These migrants are not legitimate asylum seekers.
Trump has tried to clamp down on asylum claims in many different ways. A few weeks ago, he issued a proclamation stating that people crossing the U.S.-Mexico border without going through an official port of entry could not claim asylum. Late last night, a federal court in San Francisco temporarily blocked that ruling. American Civil Liberties Union attorney Lee Gelernt argued that case. Lee Gelernt, how did the court rule?
The court ruled in our favor and squarely held that what the administration is doing is illegal, that it violates federal law enacted by Congress. Congress has made absolutely clear that where you enter the country cannot affect your ability to apply for asylum. The president is simply trying to sweep away congressional law. The judge said he'll have none of that and that Congress's enactment controls.
Yeah, so why is it not reasonable for the country's commander-in-chief to require asylum seekers to present themselves at official ports of entry?
The legal answer is straightforward, and that's because Congress has made a decision that people should be allowed to apply for asylum between ports of entry. Now, to be absolutely clear about this, no one is condoning entering between ports of entry, not Congress, not us. There are federal penalties for entering between ports of entry. What's going on here is that asylum is special. It's unique. It's fundamental. And what Congress recognizes, what the international community also recognizes, that there will be people who enter between ports of entry and they need to be allowed to apply for asylum because they could be in danger. Where you enter has no bearing on how much danger you're in. And the judge also pointed out that sometimes people will enter between ports for a variety of reasons. Sometimes they simply won't know where the ports are. Sometimes there could be criminal gangs pushing them through to other places. Sometimes, as is going on now, the administration will not be allowing people to apply at ports or creating such long lines that people are in serious danger, waiting weeks and weeks with little children in Mexico just to apply at ports. And so what Congress has said is, look, you're not supposed to enter between a port of entry, but if you do, the one right you have is to apply for asylum, because asylum is to ensure that you're not sent back to danger and possibly death. And so regardless of where you enter, you must be allowed to apply for asylum.
The judge's ruling is only effective until December 19th. What happens then, going back to Trump's ruling?
No, the judge's ruling goes till December 19th when we have a preliminary injunction hearing. He will then extend the TRO, or he could rule for the government and change his mind. Either way, I suspect that the losing party will take this case to the Federal Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit.
ACLU attorney Lee Gelernt, he argued the case that overturned President Trump's asylum ban. Lee, I know you're running on little sleep. We really appreciate your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Starting today, recreational marijuana goes on sale in pot shops here in Massachusetts. We're the only state east of the Mississippi to do this. Legalizing cannabis is not without controversy, but some of marijuana's biggest proponents are veterans with PTSD. There's another substance that's being sought out by vets and all sorts of people who suffer from psychological trauma. It comes from South America. Ayahuasca is still listed as a Schedule I drug. That means it's on the U.S. government's list of the most dangerous drugs out there. Ayahuasca is illegal in the U.S., and it's also potentially deadly. We're going to hear more about what it does in this next story. Typically, in indigenous ceremonies, ayahuasca is administered by a shaman. In a new docuseries on the Viceland channel, Kentucky Ayahuasca, the shaman is Steve Hupp, not someone you'd expect for this job.
Ayahuasca is a hallucinogenic tea made with plants from the Amazon, and it is the strongest psychedelic known to man. But this isn't like LSD. Ayahuasca is a portal to your inner self, your subconscious. And through that portal, you're going to meet a goddess we call Mother Aya. When your journey first takes off, you may feel euphoria until, boom, the spike hits and the purge begins.
Steve Hupp joins me now from station WKU Public Broadcasting in Bowling Green, Kentucky. Thanks for being with us, Steve. When were you first introduced to ayahuasca, and when did you convert, if we can call this a conversion?
Okay, the first time I heard the word ayahuasca was in federal prison, and it was from a cellmate who, for this purpose, I will call Loopy. His first name was Guadalupe. He told me about ayahuasca in federal prison. Of course, we didn't have it there, and I was like, ah, what? And the more I got to talk to him and get to know him, I realized he had a different perspective on life. And the reason he was there, he had overstayed his visa and was being deported. Long story short, that's when I heard about ayahuasca, but I didn't get to experience it for some years later. And that's when Guadalupe, I mailed his sister in Peru, and he sent me a 2-liter bottle marked dog shampoo. That's how he got it into the country to me. I didn't come out of that garage for 6 days. It wasn't puppies and kittens. It wasn't unicorns and pixies. It was brutal.
I mean, a lot of people hearing this might say this sounds kind of flaky, but I mean, the end result is supposed to be a kind of healing and dealing with trauma. What was that in your case?
You're talking about somebody who had just come out of federal prison. I mean, I'd committed multiple bank robberies, car thefts, and things I can't even talk about.
And here you're consuming a Schedule I drug.
Controlled substance, yes, from a guy that I met in federal prison who got it into the country by dog shampoo. That's how crazy this was. And here I am. I'm a stone-cold atheist. I am very firm in my beliefs that there is nothing on the other side. And now I'm confronted with the other side right here in my face, and there's no denying it. And there's also no denying what a jerk I had been for over 30-some years thinking I knew what the hell I was doing.
So you started making ayahuasca tea yourself and invited others to come get healed.
Well, you got to realize after that experience there, I was on fire to learn how to brew this. And I wanted to bring this to America. You know, I didn't think it should be held back for just rich people who could afford a plane ticket to South America.
Let me bring in Cynthia Childs, the producer of Kentucky Ayahuasca, and she joins us from NPR West. Cynthia, how did you find out about Steve Hupp and his ceremonies using ayahuasca?
We were interested in developing a show in the ayahuasca space. And through our research, we met a gentleman who was working with veterans with PTSD. And he told us about the success that Steve was having with ayahuasca in helping veterans with their PTSD. And once you meet Steve, he is an incredible character, as you can tell. And it was intriguing. And we started observing his ceremonies. And from there, we knew that we had to make a show about him.
When you say the ayahuasca space, are you kind of almost an activist for alternative medicines, alternative forms of healing?
I'm an activist for anything that helps people.
So the episode that I saw, there was Taylor, a 25-year-old woman, and she took part in one of these ceremonies. Her goal was breaking free of her sex addiction.
Stuff I'd been holding back for years, stuff I hadn't even taken the time to realize was hurting me, all washed over me at once. And it was like I expected to vomit, and I would have rather shit in my pants than cried in front of that many people and cameras, but it felt so much better.
It's really intense to watch Taylor go through this. I mean, there's a lot of intense emotion, re-traumatization, and in front of other people and cameras. This series delves into some really intimate moments, Cynthia. Can you take us behind the scenes? Like, how do you and the production team get in there and film a shaman ceremony and these gut-wrenching therapy sessions?
Well, it's an incredible balancing act because you're dealing with a medicine that makes people sensitive to light, sensitive to sound, and then you're, you know, taking a production crew into that space. So it's at odds, you know, with what we're trying to achieve, which is allowing the medicine to do its work. It was important to step out of the way and observe. And beyond that, we took Steve's lead. I mean, Steve was our shaman as well. Mm. You know, he was our guide into this space. Steve and Terry, his wife, the shamanista. And, you know, if they felt we needed to back off, we backed off.
How do you deal with the legal side of this? Because it is a controlled substance, and we're seeing these people consume it on national television.
You know, Steve can speak to this as well, but he has a Native American church, and ayahuasca is their sacrament. Hmm. So everyone that comes and drinks is a member of the church when they drink the ayahuasca.
Steve, the show is called Kentucky Ayahuasca, the conceit being, I think, that this mind-expanding drug found a home in, of all places, Kentucky. What kind of reception are you getting in this rural part of Kentucky where you live?
Well, I want to be crystal clear here. The community has been very open to allowing us to operate in Taylor County, Kentucky. They didn't understand what we were doing at first, and at first I wasn't too open with them with what I was doing. We kind of kept it on the down low and worked with people out of state. But as we kept going over the years, of course, it leaked out what we were doing, and I'm going to be honest with you, I couldn't ask for a better bunch of people to live with and be with than my kinsmen here in Kentucky.
You know, one of my favorite scenes, Steve, is when you speak with Taylor, who we heard from earlier, about her teddy bear snuggles. She brings it to the ceremony, and you offered her this advice.
See, up until this point, snuggles has been a symbol of security for you. And I'd like to help transform snuggles into a symbol of freedom. You see, when I was in prison, there was no more of a secure place. But I wasn't free. And I wasn't happy. So security is not always the best thing to seek. Freedom is the real choice.
Yeah, freedom is a real choice. I mean, you seem like a natural for this kind of work, but psychotherapy, and this is a form of psychotherapy, requires training. I mean, do you have training? And what happens if things do go wrong during an ayahuasca ceremony? People start freaking out.
Well, the training I have is being locked up in a cage for years with paranoid schizophrenics, sociopaths, and people in uniform and powerful positions that weren't always what they said they were. Now, that's the most I'm going to graze my prison experience, but let's just say those years spent entombed in that very painful of an environment was my monastery. It was my training. I spent my whole time at a federal medical center, and that's where they did psychological evaluations for courts. All kinds of things happened at FMC Lexington. Long story short, that's where I got trained on handling people with freakouts. That's why we've never had a medical emergency in all the years that I've worked with people. We've never harmed a single soul. Our motto is we're going to leave people better than we found them. And as long as we're doing that, I don't think anybody is going to stand in our way.
I mean, you said this is an intense and potentially dangerous drug. It takes you to some dark places. Do you talk to people and assess them and say, you know what, you're not really ready for this?
Oh, absolutely. We have an application process that we stick to religiously, and I'm going to be honest with you. That was a creation of my wife, Terry, the whole application process, and it has probably been the fundamental foundation of why we can safely work with some of the most unstable people and come out with some of the most miraculous results.
Cynthia, as I said, I've only seen one episode involving three people who have trauma in their lives, and ayahuasca seems to have been a start in their healing process. You mentioned ayahuasca as therapy for vets with PTSD, and we know there are all sorts of accounts of ayahuasca being the turning point in the lives of people with all kinds of trauma. From what you've seen of what Steve does, where can the Schedule I drug, ayahuasca, take us?
I think there's a lot of hope right now with psychedelics and healing, and not only with ayahuasca. I think it's something that needs to be researched more, but I think it's great to have that beacon of hope out there and to have alternative medicine that has results. And it's been thrilling to see the work that Steve does. And, you know, we follow up after every episode with the participants, and there I can tell you that I've seen it. I've documented people whose lives were changed by doing these ceremonies with Steve.
Steve, I'm curious, have you ever been to Peru or Colombia and taken ayahuasca there? And if you have, what is that experience like? How does it differ?
No, I haven't. I haven't felt the need to go to Peru, Brazil, or Colombia, Ecuador. Mother is with us wherever we go. And you know, it doesn't matter where you're at. You could do this in a cathedral or you could do it in a storage locker. And I want to state this. We do not view ayahuasca in any way, shape, or form as recreational. There's nothing fun about this, but there is a lot to be had from it.
Shaman Steve Hupp and Cynthia Childs is the series producer of the new docuseries Kentucky Ayahuasca. Thank you both very much for being with us.
Thank you for
Thank
having
you.
Us.
Kentucky Ayahuasca premieres next week on Viceland. You can watch a trailer to the series on The World's Facebook page. The air today over parts of California is hazy and dark. It's also nasty to breathe because of the wildfires. Look at the whole planet, though. There are many other causes of air pollution, like burning fossil fuels. A new study from the University of Chicago says air pollution is the single greatest risk to human health on Earth. In fact, it shaves 2 years off of the average life expectancy. Economist Michael Greenstone is the lead author of that study.
Most of the problem is concentrated in Asia. There are also pockets in Africa and Eastern Europe. But there are plenty of places in Asia, particularly in China and India and Nepal, where people's life expectancy is being cut short by 6 years or more.
And how do you track that?
The basis of this is a pair of studies that looked at what economists like to call a natural experiment in China, where people were exposed unintentionally to high levels of air pollution for their entire lives relative to very similar people who were exposed to lower levels of air pollution. And then you just measure what the excess mortality rates are in the higher pollution places, and you can turn that into life expectancy loss. That's on the life expectancy side. And then I combine that with hyper-localized particulate matter readings from satellites around the entire globe. And those two are the foundation for this exercise.
Explain particulate matter. What is that?
Particulate matter are small particles that are related to combustion of fossil fuels. That's coal, oil, and to a lesser degree, natural gas. And they are these tiny particles that are able to get inside the body. So if you think back to high school biology, you envision those little hair in your lungs called
right.
cilia, and they're so small that they can get past the cilia. The bigger particles you'll cough up and the body will expel them. But they're so – the small particulate matter will get inside the body and wreak havoc. They've been shown to lead to all kinds of cardiorespiratory problems that increase the probability of early death.
So as an economist, you had to cram really hard on anatomy and medicine.
Yeah. So my comparative advantage is not the pathophysiological mechanism. I just read papers about that. You know, it's probably also worth noting that what the study is trying to do is to stand up a new metric for air pollution. And that's what we're calling the Air Quality Life Index. The one people have traditionally used is called the Air Quality Index. And the problem with the Air Quality Index is it has no real connection to people's well-being or people's health. It reports colors, you know, orange, brown, red. And, you know, I have a hard time keeping track. Do I want orange or do I want brown or do I want maroon? It's a little bit hard to keep track of. But the key thing is none of that relates to human health. And what I've done here is convert air pollution concentrations into losses of life expectancy. And, you know, it's difficult to think of a more important metric than is your life going to be shorter?
So you find that air pollution is a greater threat to human life than cigarette smoking. For real?
So let's be very clear. If every man, woman, and child started smoking, then the effects of cigarette smoking would be greater. But given the current rates of cigarette smoking today, particulate air pollution shaves more years off global life expectancy than cigarette smoking.
Are there other things that you compare air pollution to?
Yeah, we compare air pollution to tuberculosis, to war and terrorism, road injuries, HIV, AIDS. We really tried to find things that were largely external sources of mortality. And air pollution was found to be the largest.
Even compared to war?
Yes, even compared to war.
That's incredible. Economist Michael Greenstone at the University of Chicago, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
New York City's delicatessens are becoming an endangered species. Katz's is still open, but the Carnegie Deli, gone. The Stage, gone. If we here on The World are going to sing the praises of an old-school deli, one that turns 90 today, in fact, we've got to go to Montreal. Schwartz's. The classic order there is smoked meat on rye. Frank Silva is the general manager at Schwartz's. Thanks for being here, Frank. How are you celebrating the 90th anniversary of Schwartz's today? This is a big day.
Well, it's not actually today, but we've been doing things all year round. And today we're treating our loyal customers to a sandwich, a French fry, and a Coke beverage for $1.09.
$1.09. Is there any significance to the price?
Well, the owners did a little bit of research, and they believe it must have been around that price in 1928.
The reason you're doing this today is that the actual anniversary is on December 31st, right? And standing outside would be pretty chilly.
Yeah, correct. And we're crazy busy that day as it is already. So this is why I picked November 20th.
Just take us back 90 years. How did the story of Schwartz's begin?
Mr. Ruben Schwartz, a Romanian immigrant, opened it up in 1928. And obviously, he struggled back then. Times were very lean. But over the years, it's growing. The exact same recipe since 1928. We haven't modernized. We have no microwaves, no desserts, no espressos, no lattes. Exactly. It's basically smoked meat, potatoes, and beverage.
I mean, it's arguably the best known restaurant in Montreal, Schwartz's. What makes it so popular?
It's so damn good. That's all it is. It's just great food and consistent. It's always It's always good.
Yeah, no, I can attest to how delicious it is. I used to live in Plattsburgh, and Montreal and Schwartz's was my fun getaway. So Celine Dion, she became a co-owner. How'd that happen?
Somehow Renee Angelil, her husband, was an extremely big fan of Schwartz's, was coming here all the time with Celine, of course. So he heard about this, and he said, I need to be a partner.
Does Celine Dion ever pop into Schwartz's? I mean, will she be there today to grab one of the $1.09 specials?
No, she's not coming for the special. She actually doesn't pay, and nobody pays when she's in here. When she shows
no
up,
kidding.
Nobody pays. It's all free.
I'm just curious, what do you think the story of Schwartz's tells us about the history of immigration to Montreal? I mean, Reuben Schwartz came from Romania, right?
That's right. Actually, he started it. And ever since Schwartz's, now I got roughly 50 employees, and I probably have employees from 20 countries working here. And it's always immigrants are in here. We're a big, happy family from all over the world. And the customers also. It's not only Jewish customers. It's you name it. They're in here. Everybody's enjoying a great sandwich.
Yeah, and is it like, you know, you go to Katz's in New York and you say, give me a schmear of mustard on that. Will people know what a schmear means in Montreal?
Absolutely. And I have them in Katz's also, and it's a great sandwich. But I think ours is better.
Frank Silva, the general manager at Schwartz's in Montreal. I know it's a little early, but happy birthday to all of you, and thanks.
Thank you.
Okay, I know what I want to eat for Thanksgiving. The $1.09 special ended this afternoon, though. I will pay top dollar for Schwartz's. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH, I'm Marco Werman. Back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.